It's 5:06 and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, proposed legislation would make it illegal to give misleading info about polling places and times on Election Day in Wisconsin. The sponsor of the bill tells us why.
First, there's been a lot of talk about income inequality in American politics lately, including a prominent mention in the president's State of the Union address last week.
Today, after 4 years of economic growth, corporate profits and stock prices have rarely been higher, and those at the top have never done better. But average wages have barely budged. Inequality has deepened. Upward mobility has stalled.
Our next guest says while poverty and economic opportunity are important issues, a lot of the talk about inequality may be pointing us in the wrong directions. Ron Haskins joins us now. He's co-director of the Brookings Center on Children and Families and the Budgeting for National Priorities Project. He recently offered testimony to the House Budget Committee on these issues. Ron, welcome back to the show.
Glad to be here.
Well, you heard the president's concern about inequality there, but you warn in your testimony about politicians falling into an inequality trap. What do you mean by that?
Well, let me say first, the president was quite mild compared to the way he was in the past. He did not talk nearly as much about inequality as you might expect him to, and did not even mention the 1%, which has been a target of all kinds of, politicians in recent years. So I think he's trying to placate Republicans a little bit, trying to get something done, and hopefully Republicans will respond in kind, which, by the way, they seem to be doing. The idea is that if you cast this debate as one about inequality, it immediately leads to an argument about the poor distribution of resources in American society, about the upper 1%. Some people call that class warfare. It's not at all clear that doing something to the upper 1% is going to make poor people any better off. In fact, a lot of people in the upper 1% invest their money and choose to invest in companies, which in turn produces jobs and so forth. So it's just not very productive. We should focus on what we need to do to increase mobility. That's a much better way to frame the debate. And we need to help kids be more mobile and move beyond where their parents were.
And the president said in that clip, upward mobility has stalled. Is he right about that?
I don't think, well, it's kind of a clever word. Stalled, yes. If you want to say that upward mobility has been relatively the same for about four decades now, then it's stalled. It's been stalled for four decades. Previously, though, that's progress, because previously he said it had deepened. In several of the speeches, he made that claim, and that claim is just not consistent with the facts. There's little, if any, evidence that mobility has actually declined. It's still not good. It's a problem enough that we have less mobility in the United States than many other countries have, and it's so important. Think of this. Here's a statistic that almost everybody would agree with. A child born to parents with income in the bottom 20% of income in the United States, for a single mom, that would be somewhere around $20,000 a year. That child has a 40% chance of themselves winding up in the bottom, so twice what it would be if everything else was equal. That's the kind of lack of mobility we have in the United States, and that's something that's been hard in the last several years for Republicans to face up to. But many of them have done it and have admitted not only do we have a serious problem with equality, but mobility is not what it should be, and that's what we should focus on. We should focus our policy on promoting mobility, especially for kids in the bottom.
One argument about that lack of mobility for people in that lower 20% is a decline in maybe manufacturing jobs that would have offered a higher wage that they could get possibly without anything beyond a high school degree, and those opportunities aren't there anymore. But you're saying the statistics aren't worse now than they were before?
They're not. In fact, the Congressional Budget Office, think of them as the referee in Washington. They do analyses. They estimate the cost of bills. They give all kinds of projections about the budget. And they, from time to time, publish reports about issues like inequality and opportunity. And they recently have published a series of reports that have caused some controversy. But as I say, CBO is widely respected, nonpartisan, And they argue that if you count all government benefits and you look at the income distribution and divide it into five equal parts, called quintiles, that households in all five of those quintiles have advanced since 1979, which is exactly the opposite of what many, many people are claiming. And it's because they count government benefits. If you don't count government benefits, then the point you just made about manufacturing and the lack of increase in wages over the years, especially at the bottom of the distribution, in fact, up to maybe 30 or 40% of the distribution, there's been very, very little progress. Nonetheless, because of government benefits, and especially because of something called the Earned Income Tax Credit, all families in all five quintiles are doing better. And that really had an impact in Washington because, as I say, people have a lot of confidence in the Congressional Budget Office. And so many people have cited this report.
But including government benefits, I think you could probably get broad agreement across the spectrum that all else being equal, we'd rather have people having that upward mobility thanks to getting a good paying job instead of counting on government benefits for part of that increase.
We certainly would. But what are you going to do if there are a lot of low-wage jobs and if a lot of people have poor education? Here is what I think the heart of the problem is, and I think a lot of economists would agree with this. And the heart of the problem is that just at the moment when our economy, because of competition and because of technology, is creating jobs that require a high level of skill, much higher than in the past, that is the moment at which kids in the bottom of the distribution are not doing well in school. They're not improving. In fact, research shows pretty clearly they come to school considerably behind other children, and the schools increase how far they are behind. This applies to low-income families. Here's something really interesting. The gap in achievement, so-called, between black kids and white kids has actually declined over the past couple of decades. But the gap between kids from low-income and poor families and more advantaged children has increased for at least the past three decades. So that's why I say they are not getting the education and the skills that they need. We're in a permanent state of reform in our public schools. We've tried many, many things. We have a lot more preschool than we had in the past, and yet these huge discrepancies in achievement level get worse and worse and worse.
Let's chase that point a little further, this idea of the achievement gap, the big achievement gap in education being between the top of, like, I guess, the income spectrum and the bottom.
Not even the top and the bottom, even the middle and the bottom.
Mm. Well, in your testimony that I referred to earlier, you started offering some solutions, some policy suggestions on issues of upward mobility, the things we're talking about here, and the achievement gap was one of them. How can we start to tackle the achievement gap?
Well, a lot of people have confidence in preschool. I do, too. I have a substantial background. I used to work with one of the best-known preschools, so-called Abecedarian program in North Carolina. But you have to admit, if you look at the data, that it's somewhat discouraging. There was a national evaluation of Head Start, which is by far the nation's biggest preschool programs, and it did not produce encouraging results. There was some impact at the end of the program, but the impacts faded. Some people say they come back later. And there was a recent, very good study published in Tennessee of a pretty large-scale preschool program with the same results, very nice impacts at the end of the pre-K year, roughly when the kids were age four, but no effects at the end of the first year of the public schools. The effects had faded. So I think most people would agree that if we had high-quality preschool with high-quality teachers who were engaging the children in activities that increase not only their intellect but also their social-emotional development, and if they were working with peers who were working in a cooperative fashion and had these kinds of experiences in preschool, that could make a big difference. There are preschools like one in Boston and one in Tulsa, Oklahoma, and other places in the country that do seem to make a difference, and there are some effects that continue into the public school. So I think preschool is a big part of it. Another part I think is going to be in the long run that we're going to do a better job of figuring out how low-income kids who don't necessarily do great in the public schools – go to community colleges and other training opportunities or be in apprenticeship programs and acquire skills that will allow them to have good jobs for $40,000 or $50,000 or $60,000 a year with benefits. Incidentally, right along these lines, I was in Wisconsin last year in a forum that was put on by a University of Wisconsin for state legislators and their staffs, and they had several businessmen there, and one businessman said that they are losing money because they can't find skilled welders. That was the example he brought up. And that if they could find welders, they would pay them handsomely, they would have benefits and everything, but they just can't find enough skilled welders. And that's a story that occurs all across the country. The solution, I think, is to develop training programs that are focused on jobs available in the local economy that actually train kids and give them the skills that they need to fill those jobs. That would go a long way toward reducing inequality and promoting opportunity.
We're talking to Ron Haskins with the Brookings Institution about inequality, poverty, and economic mobility in the United States. We just heard one of his policy suggestions. We'll get to some more coming up in just a few minutes.
And you can join the program. Are you worried about economic inequality in the United States? And do you think the president is right to focus on the issue? You can call us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or email us at talk@WPR.org. We continue our conversation about inequality, income mobility, and opportunity with Ron Haskins of the Brookings Institution.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts about income inequality, whether it's a top issue for you, what kind of policies you'd like to change, either to address inequality or to boost income mobility, people being able to move up from the lowest part of the economy to higher parts over their lifetime. Get your calls in just a few moments. But Ron, one thing you talked about in your testimony to the U.S. House is family structure as an obstacle to mobility and to getting people out of poverty. Can you speak to the role that plays?
Yes, there's no question that this is a huge part of the problem. We have had an explosion of female-headed families in the United States over the past four decades. With a colleague at the University of Wisconsin, Maria Kanchin, we just analyzed the decennial census data since 1970 and showed a huge decline in marriage rates, and as a result of that, a huge increase in non-marital birth rates, which means a big increase in single-parent families. So almost a doubling of the percentage of kids in single-parent families. And the issue here is that kids from single-parent families do worse in general. In the schools, they're more likely to be arrested. They're less likely to go to college. There are a whole series of deficits that kids from single-parent families have. And if you have a big increase in the number of kids in single-parent families, then you're asking for trouble. For one thing, kids in single-parent families are four times as likely to live in poverty as kids in married couple families. So no one thinks being in poverty is good for children, plus all those other effects on development. So that is definitely a big part of this problem, that kids are less prepared. I've already said that the problems with education are one of the fundamental causes of the lack of mobility and the stubbornness of poverty in our society, and one of the causes is the increase in single-parent families.
So what do you do about that? I've seen arguments that we should be incentivizing marriage, or arguments that we should be providing more types of government support to those single parents. What kind of things do you think might work?
Both. There's no question that for the foreseeable future, we are going to have a very high percentage of our children reared in single-parent families. In fact, some estimates are that as many as half of America's children will spend some time during their childhood in a single-parent family. And at any given moment, over 25% of our kids are in a single-parent family. So we need to help support single parents. Many of the single parents are less skilled. They're school dropouts or maybe high school graduates, and they don't earn much. And so we have created a number of programs at both the federal level and the state level. Wisconsin is exemplary in this matter. That subsidize the earnings. Americans seem to have a lot less trouble. They don't necessarily like welfare very much. They want people to try. So if you have a low-wage job, as so many mothers do, then the public is not opposed to providing them with income supplements like the Earned Income Tax Credit, food stamps, help with child care, medical coverage for the children, and once Obamacare is fully implemented, most of the mothers as well. So we are already providing a lot of support to these single mothers, and that we should continue to do and even improve in some ways, because such a high percentage of our kids are going to be reared in those families.
I want to get to our callers and bring them on us in on this now. Stephen is with us in Dubuque, Iowa. Stephen, hi.
Hi, I just wanted to talk about the policy recommendation that your guest had about increasing opportunities for training programs, specifically welding. I have this debate with my wife a lot because she works in economic development and needs this to happen basically to fill jobs, but I work in higher education and sometimes worry that focusing too much on that specifically for low-income people is limiting their potential, especially when they can be singled out and these programs are specifically for them. So I don't think that they're a negative and that they won't work. I just also worry that sometimes focusing on that will limit their potential and not show them that they can obtain a four-year degree. So I definitely think that doing that alongside opening higher education, offering student support so that students can succeed when they get to college can be a good combination of the two solutions.
Stephen, thanks for the call. So provide lower-income people, I think he's saying, the opportunity for vocational school and four-year degrees. What do you think, Ron?
I think it's a legitimate concern. I think the data does not necessarily support the idea that we are restricting kids from going on for four-year degrees because they try to get a two-year degree or a certificate or training in some skill. But it's something we should be concerned about. I think the real concern lies in the other direction. We have so many low-income kids who get accepted to college. They go to college. They borrow money. And then they don't finish school because they don't have the skills from high school to finish college. And so they wind up carrying a fairly large student debt. And they don't get the benefit of an education to get a better job. So I think that's an even more important problem. But I'm not denying what the caller is saying is a concern. I just don't think the evidence is that it's a problem.
Back to the phones now. We've got Willem with us in Colfax. Hi, Willem.
Hi. I just wanted to address the point that your guest made earlier about how, you know, income inequality, that you don't want to take anything away from the top because they're responsible for investing in creating new jobs, but there's no evidence that shows they're doing that or doing that their investment might be rare minerals in the Congo or some factory in Vietnam. Or the money travels all over the world, just like oil and other resources. It's a global market, so there's no guarantee by, you know what I mean. It's a sort of trickle-down economics, and I think that really, the beginning of this slide happened under the Reagan administration, their attack on labor, and now with education. How are you going to have high-quality education when the prevailing politics is calling teachers union thugs and disrespecting what they do and all? They get all this time off. And you know,
all right, I'm going to jump in, Willem, because we don't have too much time for a response from Ron Haskins. The main point there that it's back to the debate. The wealthy, the 1% are job creators, or no, they're not. Where do you stand on that, Ron?
Well, wait. I want to correct something the caller said. I did not say we shouldn't take money from the top. We have one of the most progressive tax codes in the world. The bottom 40% of taxpayers pay negative federal taxes because of their income tax credit and the child tax credit, and the upper 20% pay a huge percentage, over 70% of total taxes are from the upper 20%. So we have a very, very progressive tax code. And I think that's as it should be. And we have debates all the time about whether we should tax the upper, you know, 5 or 10 or 20% more, which we decided to do 2 years ago. And Republicans even agreed to that in a compromise. So we do a lot of that already. And there is no question that there's tons of investment in jobs. Now, the caller may be right. I don't know. I don't know exactly what the date is. A lot of rich people spend money on yachts and so forth, and maybe some people resent that. But I think most Americans believe that if you earn money and run a factory or invest your money, that you should be able to enjoy the fruits of your labor.
Ron, we're just about out of time, but do you think that there can be bipartisan agreement on some of the suggestions you've made without getting the divisive partisan rhetoric in the middle of it?
There will always be divisive rhetoric, especially in recent years, has shown that quite clearly. But yes, I think I'm a little bit, not a lot, I'm a little bit optimistic. Republicans have started to make proposals. Rubio, Paul Ryan, others have made proposals that I think liberals would like. In fact, I know they would, especially on expansions of the earned income tax credit. So, yes, I think there is a possibility. There'll still be an ugly debate, but that's the name of the game in Washington. But I think there could be some progress.
Ron, thanks a lot for joining us today.
I'm glad to be here. Thank you.
Ron Haskins with the Brookings Institution talking about his recent testimony on inequality and opportunity before the House Budget Committee.
It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, it's our weekly On Congress segment. USA Today Politics and Congress editor Paul Singer will give us an update on what's happening in our nation's capital this week.
But first, a new bill in Wisconsin would make it illegal to give out false information about elections. It's called the Honest Elections Bill, and Democratic State Representative Mandela Barnes unveiled it this afternoon.
Representative Barnes is with us to explain how this bill would change existing election law and why it's necessary here in Wisconsin. He's a Democrat from Milwaukee. He represents the 11th Assembly District. Representative Barnes, thanks for joining us.
Hey, thank you for having me this afternoon.
How would this bill change existing election law here in Wisconsin?
Well, what the bill would do is it would criminalize the activity of providing false or misleading information intentionally to deceive voters or to manipulate outcomes in whatever area that you're exercising this practice in. Currently, it's not a law in the book, but it will put the act of purposely providing false information on par with regular voter fraud activity. Essentially, it would add this as an infraction.
What kind of false information are we talking about? Saying come to the election on Tuesday the 4th and the election's really on the 11th, or giving the wrong polling place? Is that the kind of thing you're looking at?
There's absolutely been instances like this, and I've seen personally in my days as an organizer where there will be times in low voter turnout areas, typically where we see the fall-off voters, people who don't vote in every single election, people who come out for the big ones, whether it's for the president or for a governor's race. What you will sometimes see is people who say, well, due to high expected turnout, I mean, there's been flyers that said, due to high expected turnout, you'll be allowed to vote Wednesday also, so don't waste your time standing in line. There's been instances, even I've had conversations with my friends in other states who are legislators, and they talked about times where there's been robocalls to specific houses of people who aren't regular voters providing the same type of false information. And one person even said they've gone so far as to skip the robocalls and have live dialers calling people, telling them that they can vote on another day, or even vote by phone. And even also in the recall election, there were instances where people said, well, if you sign the recall, that means you don't have to go vote because that is your vote. And, you know, some people fell for that information, or some people, you know, decide, hey, let me give this another look, and told someone about it, and then were, you know, instructed otherwise that this is not the case. I mean, and it, you know, it's not to attack any one party at all. It's not just if you vote Democrat or if you vote Republican, your vote should be protected. This is for people all across the entire state of Wisconsin.
So these are things I think people would usually think of as dirty tricks, trying to keep people from voting or having them show up the wrong day or time. This isn't currently illegal, you say?
Right.
So what would the penalty be if this bill passed?
So this would be a Class I felony, as is any other type of voter fraud. Meaning that it could be up to 3.5 years or a $10,000 fortune, or excuse me, forfeiture. This would be obviously the maximum. But it would, the same charges that, or the same penalty that's on the books for a voter fraud conviction will be the same charge that you would receive for potentially taking away someone's right to franchise. And, you know, it's a supreme right. It should be protected. It's the great equalizer between the rich and the poor, whatever race you are, religion, sexual orientation, gender, you have one vote, and you shouldn't have that vote compromised by anyone.
As far as you know, is this the first time we've seen a legislative effort to tackle these tactics?
So I'm not aware in the state of Wisconsin of a legislative action being attempted. Again, I had a chance to speak with some of my fellow legislative colleagues from other states a while last summer, and it was an issue that they talked about.
And speaking of legislative colleagues, you unveiled this today, but have you sought out opinions from your colleagues in the Wisconsin state legislature to see if there's a chance this thing could pass?
Well, I've absolutely. We sent this out for co-sponsorship memo or for co-sponsorship, and they're, I'll be in Madison tomorrow. I'll absolutely be speaking to some of my colleagues on the other side of the aisle specifically about it. Again, it's not a partisan bill by any means. It's something that's equal in application, equal in penalty, and I think that it's sort of a no-brainer. I think that we all can agree that people shouldn't have their right to franchise tampered with.
Are you hoping that, in part, that having this law in existence would be kind of a deterrent for people doing this in the first place? Maybe the punishment wouldn't have to be applied that often if people knew it was there?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely, a deterrent. People should know that this is not acceptable behavior in any democracy, not just the state of Wisconsin, just any democracy in general.
And do you think having a law like this on the books, what would it do for people's confidence in elections here in the state?
Well, I think it absolutely helps. But, and for people to know that, it's unlawful for people to provide them false information, I think it does a lot to the confidence of voters. And personally, I wish people voted in every election. I think that civic participation is very important, but for one reason or another, some people only come out for certain elections. And not being a regular voter, when that time passes in between those big elections, you may fall for someone saying that, hey, the rules have changed since you were here 2 years ago. The rules have changed since you were here 4 years ago. So,
is this a way to do it, by punishing people who do these things, or would it be smarter to do more with voter education, get the accurate news out there, and make sure the public is aware of their rights and how they vote?
Well, voter education is still huge. That piece has to happen, but there has to be both sides of the coin. I don't think that if we're gonna talk about voter fraud being an issue, I mean, voter education would also solve that problem. But if there's a law in the books that is to deter voter fraud by penalty, then there should also be a law that deters the other form of voter fraud by penalty.
So before we let you go, I want to get your perspective from the vantage of a legislator from Milwaukee. What other things do you think could be done, apart from this legislation, to increase voter turnout, increase people's confidence, increase the sense of enfranchisement in Wisconsin politics?
Mm-hmm. So I think the voter turnout is on an individual basis, but what we've seen in the last few elections, even in 2010, we saw a higher... It was higher than usual in fall 2010 when the recall came around. There were record numbers in wards that did not traditionally turn out. And in this last presidential election, we had record numbers in the city of Milwaukee. I think that people obviously they see the importance of these larger elections. However, the importance of the smaller elections, the more local elections, is not immediately known. And I think that a better effort to get people out, get people energized and excited to come out of the house to vote for these local elections, for people to understand the consequences of those elections. People understood the consequences of a gubernatorial race. People saw what happened, even when they turned out for the recall. People were disappointed. They were energized, and they had a specific reason to go out and vote in record numbers. And then the presidential races, I mean, obviously, going to bring out higher numbers than our local elections anyway.
Representative Barnes, thanks so much for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you guys for having me. It's a great time.
That was Representative Mandela Barnes. He's a Democrat from Milwaukee. He represents the 11th Assembly District. We were talking about the Honest Election Bill he unveiled earlier today. It's time for our weekly look at Congress. Last week, we considered changes in the new Farm Bill. That bill has now passed both houses, passed the Senate yesterday, and it's being sent to President Obama for a signature. If you missed that discussion, you can check it out on Central Times page at WPR.org.
Well, on the table this week, the debt limit suspension that reopened the government last October expires on Friday, and the Treasury is expected to run out of money around the end of the month.
The federal deficit has also fallen dramatically. We'll see what that means for Congress. Here with us is Paul Singer, Congress and Politics editor at USA Today. He joins us every Wednesday at this time to catch us up on one of America's most disliked legislatures in history. Paul, always good to have you with us.
Nice to be here. Nice intro.
Well, and in that intro, we mentioned the government shutdown and reopened last October. Okay, and we were done worrying about debt ceilings and so forth until Friday, when the debt limit suspension, I gather, expires. Are we back again where we started?
It's funny. We were not expecting to be back where we started. The theory was, as of about 10 days ago, Republicans didn't want to have this fight again. They think the shutdown affected them badly. They have lost some leverage because government funding for the year has already been approved. So, you know, they don't really want to default on debt, on the nation's debt. They don't want to be blamed for it. So the assumption was they were going to just sort of allow this one to pass. Well, the problem is that there is not consensus within the Republican conference about what to do. There are a handful of sort of Tea Party and ideologically conservative deficit hawks, I guess you'd call them, or debt hawks in this case, who really just don't want to raise the debt and don't want to vote yes. So the question is, are there enough votes to pass the thing? And they're just not sure. And they're also not sure, the Republicans, whether there's anything they can do to sort of negotiate something that will make their members happy. Because the Obama administration has said, basically, we're not going to negotiate it at all. Pass it, up or down.
So any chance this will be taken care of by Friday?
No.
Short answer.
No. House isn't going to vote this week. Next week is a little murky because it's possible the Senate could take this thing up and pass it clean, just, you know, debt limit clean, and then leave it to the House to go figure out what to do with it. But the House, next week, Democrats take off for a couple of days for a conference of their own to plan their strategies. So there's not a lot of time next week either. It won't get done pretty clearly this week, and it won't get done. Well, if it's going to get done next week, it better be done by this time next week.
But wait a minute. The deadline's this Friday, so the government doesn't shut down this Friday. It's kind of a softish deadline, huh?
Yeah, you and your deadline. the way the debt ceiling works is basically at that point, we are now sort of at the limit of what we're allowed to borrow. But there is wiggle room. There are what they call extraordinary measures the Treasury Department can take. For instance, they can stop making some payments, or at least suspend making some payments to long-term pension funds, stuff like that. There is stuff they can do to wiggle around. They will tell you, and they have told Congress, they have much less wiggle room this time than they had last time. And the reason is tax season has begun. And so the Treasury's outflow of cash increases significantly. Basically, they start paying off all the tax returns they owe. So hundreds of billions of dollars flow out. They don't have a lot of money to monkey around with.
But it sounds as though we shouldn't be chewing our nails too badly. We're not going to get into a situation we were last October.
I don't think so. I'm not convinced this is going to become the kind of showdown that was. Because nobody really has an incentive to make that happen. I mean, even if they just figure out a way to, you know, punt it for a couple of months, that would be better. So we'll see. I'm not at this moment suggesting that anybody run for the hills.
Staying on the topic of money, the federal deficit we're reading has fallen pretty significantly. That the deficit's the annual shortfall, the debt is the running tally, so the debt is still going up. But does that decrease in the deficit change anything?
Well, I mean, it's a nice thing for the Democrats to be able to say that deficits are shrinking. One of the reasons that deficits are shrinking is that the economy is improving, so tax revenue is going up. Another reason that deficits are shrinking is because, you remember the fiscal cliff a year ago? Part of that whole fiasco was what amounted to very large tax increase, particularly on wealthy people. So then you have, again, tax revenue goes up, deficits go down. It's kind of funny. You guys up in Wisconsin, I think your governor announced a $1 billion surplus, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we do have a surplus here. They're figuring out what to do with it in Wisconsin.
Yeah, same deal. The reason they got a surplus is because tax revenues increased over what they anticipated because the economy was getting better. So, you know, it's just basic math that when you have when the economy gets stronger and tax revenue increases, you've got more of it. You can spend down your pay down your deficits, or in some cases, actually bank up surpluses. To the degree it trends that way, it'll be very good for the Democrats to be able to say, "Hey, look, we're getting closer to a balanced budget."
So the rhetoric around the deficit has been pretty intense in the past several years. With this new news in hand, is how we talk about the deficit, is that going to change?
Nah, not really. I mean, because keep in mind, Republicans can still say, okay, well, let's cut spending to keep driving the debt down, the long-term debt down. Second of all, you know, all right, our deficit is down to $500 billion. Well, that's good, but, you know, that's still real money in some people's accounting. And I think it's still I think that even with improving deficit numbers, we are still very clearly in a time of austerity. You know, we have come to a point where we have to realize, and I think the budget agreement that they agreed to late last year, earlier this year, you know, is really intended to stake out a position that is more fiscally responsible, more fiscally conservative, less spending, regardless of the deficit numbers, the year-to-year deficit numbers.
Well, let's turn to Congress's role, and I guess more specifically the Senate's role in foreign policy. The U.S. struck a deal with Iran last November during the nuclear talks. There's been tension over what to do about sanctions in Congress, and the president applying pressure, saying, watch out for those sanctions. It's going to ruin what we're talking about with Iran. What's the latest in Congress with that?
I know absolutely nothing about foreign policy. I'm proud of that. What I do know about Congress is that they, at the moment, appear to be willing to see whether these talks with Iran are going to make progress. That there have been some hopeful signs. There have been some indications that, in fact, Iran may be willing to make moves towards stepping down their nuclear program. That's good. And the White House can say and said to Congress fairly clearly, give us time to let this work before we start talking about new sanctions in Iran. And for the moment, at least, it looks like Congress has been willing to say, well, okay. I'm not sure they have a whole lot to gain, honestly, in Congress from trying to push a new sanctions bill now. You know, why? As long as the headlines coming out of Iran are decent, why push your luck? Because it won't be hard for them to pass it as soon as it becomes clear that Iran is not serious. It won't be hard for them to pass new sanctions.
Well, let's move from foreign policy back to home turf. States and municipalities have been increasingly crafting their own legislation on marijuana. It doesn't look like President Obama is planning to block anything, but is Congress going to do anything when it comes to stepping in when states decide to go their own way?
It's really interesting. You know, it's a hard nut for Congress to crack. They don't necessarily have a lot of authority here. In fact, if you wanted to have the federal government crack down on states that are loosening penalties for marijuana, you would have to make the argument that the states' rights don't prevail, which is in some cases a religious argument in Congress, right? There are people who are very, very committed to states' rights and who argue that, in fact, the federal government has overstepped its bounds. And not to sort of, you know, throw the whole ball of social hot buttons at you at once, but if you want to say that states should be allowed to, for instance, ban gay marriage, then what if states want to ban gay marriage but allow marijuana? You know, I mean, it's a tough issue for Congress to get into that way when the states are deciding to do stuff on their own. There's also, I'm not sure they got a whole lot of authority, right? They could, I guess they could pass another bill saying, you know, the Justice Department shall enforce federal law even where the states are not being helpful. But I don't know if they're going to make much progress on that front. At the moment, I think watching the states play this out themselves is really where it's going to lie.
All right. I don't know if I'm surprising you here with this. I saw a couple pieces of news today. Two new likely candidates for Congress. American Idol star Clay Aiken, Saturday Night Live veteran Victoria Jackson, Democrat and Republican respectively. Will more celebrities in Congress make your job more fun?
Yeah, totally. Although, not necessarily. Like, we thought Al Franken was going to be the greatest thing to happen. You know, he was going to come and be hilarious. But, you know, he has avoided us, the national press, like we're plagued. He barely talks to us at all, and he's almost never funny. We got to go find other people to make us laugh. It's always great to have, you know, your celebrity congressperson wander down the hall. I was here when Cooter was here.
From the Dukes of Hazzard.
Yeah, and Gopher from the Love Boat. You know, we always enjoyed that.
All right, something to look forward to. Paul, thanks a lot for joining us.
All right, we'll talk to you guys later.
That was Congress and Politics editor at USA Today, Paul Singer. He joins us each Wednesday at this time to talk Congress.